Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back. So today I'm going to talk about work with some collaborators of mine. And hold on, I messed up. The slides are out of order. Sorry, that's what happens when I do some stuff last minute. What the? Okay, I'm gonna put that slide at the end because if I'm suddenly missing up. Excuse me. Okay, my second slide is my collaborators. This work is done in collaboration with fellows at Berkeley, Bing Tian and Francisco. These are both students of Norman Yao. And Christopher White, who's currently a postdoc in Maryland. All right, so the general idea that I want to ask is just the idea of quantum dynamics, which is basically if you take some quantum system and you just kind of shake it or hit it with something, what happens? And this is interesting for a variety of reasons, and some of them I'm going to talk about. And these are all important aspects of dynamics. So the first thing I'm going to ask is thermalization. And the rough idea of thermalization is basically whether a system just reaches thermal equilibrium with itself. And one thing you can ask is like if I have a system where it's hot on one side, cold on the other side, and just let it sit there, you expect it to the temperature to be uniform over time. And that comes from thermalization. And the basic question is that what happens when it thermalizes? Does it look like a Gibbs state, which we kind of take for granted in statistical mechanics? And this is particularly important, thermalization, in certain things like a quantum quench. Like a quantum quench is where you suddenly change the Hamiltonian of a quantum system and you look at how it evolves. And so the question is, does it ever thermalize and what happens? And this is also useful when you do transport because thermalization is inherently, like for you to actually get a transport measurement, you need thermalization. Ohm's law only exists because of thermalization, for example. And we do know a number of systems that does exhibit thermalization. In fact, almost many systems that we study do. It seems like the ingredient is that you need interactions. So free fermions will not thermalize. That's well understood. And you also want to avoid having too much disorder, so low disorder. So in the other limit, a system that do not thermalize includes non-interacting fermions or many body localized systems. And then there's also integrable systems, which are systems that's kind of fine-tuned to certain points where they don't thermalize. And for this talk, we're not going to study these. We're going to be looking at strongly interacting systems that thermalizes. So that's one aspect. Another aspect that I want to bring up is hydrodynamics, because that's in the title of my talk. So the question is, what is hydrodynamics? Very simply put, when I say hydrodynamics, I just meant that certain conserved quantities are governed by classical equations of motion. An example of conserved quantities is energy or charge, if there was a charge conservation. And the reason why it's called hydrodynamics is because like, it behaves like a fluid. So you can literally write some version of Navier-Stokes for these equations. One of the things about thermalization is that we expect all the observables to be determined basically by these classical variables, say energy density. And what that kind of means is that if you were in a hydrodynamic regime, it kind of means that you have basically a very simple description of your many-body system. As an example, you can describe the density matrix as some, say, spatially varying temperature profile. And then over time, of course, you can ask how that temperature profile changed. But that's an example of a case where you could describe it with hydrodynamics. All right, so that's kind of one aspect. So in other aspects and I've kind of introduced various dynamical topics here, is flow cave physics. And flow cave physics is basically anytime you have a periodic drive. And specifically, I'm going to be considering a unitary evolution. So like I'm considering a closed system periodic drive. So you just take something and you shake it. And it typically shows up, for example, the way that you couple a system to light, at least classically, is to just couple to a periodic electromagnetic field, or if AM or physics, you can vary your trap, etc. All right, so with all these kind of terms in mind, what I want you to do is to bring your attention to a particular example. Now, it's really not specifically important what this is later. This is the model I'll be talking about this talk, but you don't actually have to know the details at this point. But this is an example of a model that I want to study. So I'm gonna have some Hamiltonian that involve a static part, which is time independent, and a drive, which is a periodic part. So the static part is just some, in this case, one-dimensional Hamiltonian, which I'll talk about a bit later. And the drive part also is some local terms, but it's going to involve a time-varying piece, which is periodic with some period t. In particular, I'm going to be looking at a system that has local interactions in both the static part and the drive. So some local 1D model. And this drive is going to be periodic, so it comes with some frequency omega. One way you can think about what the drive does is that it drives transitions between different states separated by energy omega. And so as you keep driving, it could absorb or emit one of these omega quantas coming from the drive as a transition from one state to another state. So that's one way to think about it. And in doing so, all right, so we have the example. And in doing so, what typically happens is then energy is no longer conserved because the, your average energy can change as a result of that drive. It can absorb or emit an omega quanta of energy. And typically, it will drive it to an infinite system because that's the state with the largest entropy. If you're no longer, if you just take the set of all states and you don't constrain the energy, the most likely thing is the infinite temperature state. And so generically, all flow case systems drives to infinite temperature. And this feature, whether you like it or not, it's a main a problem for both theory and experiments, because infinite temperature is not as interesting as other things. But this is one problem, is that whenever you drive any experiment, it typically just heats up. So the question is there a way to avoid taking a system to infinite temperature by driving it? Because this is a generic argument. Whenever you drive it, energy is no longer conserved. The most likely state is the infinite temperature one. And it turns out there is, which is if you can make the rate of heating much, much less than the rate of thermalization. So what it means is that the system appears to go to some equilibrium, not at some finite temperature because the heating rate is so slow. Now, one obvious way to make the heating rate slow is to make the coefficient small for the drive, but that's not a very interesting regime. And so it turns out that the regime that we can achieve, as it turns out, is if you actually take the driving frequency and you make it really large. In particular, we're going to be looking at the regime where the driving frequency, it's far larger than the single particle excitation. And the logic behind this is this. Recall that I said that when we think of a flow case system, one picture is that the drive provides energy to the system and it will absorb or emit quantas of omega at a time. And the drive, of course, comes with a certain local interactions. recall of this. Now, if somehow this omega is really big, then what happens is I'm trying to connect two states that are far apart of energy with a very local interaction, and it turns out that's actually really hard. It's really hard to take, say, you know, an eigenstate and then through by applying a local operator, vastly change the energy. Typically, the amount of energy that you expect to change through one local operation, say a flip of your spin, is order J, which is kind of the energy scale in your static Hamiltonian. And so as a result, if omega is much greater than J, then you actually get an exponentially suppressed heating rate because of how hard it is to excite many, because you can only excite like kind of one local spin at a time. But then what you're trying to do is you're trying to jump really far in energy space.
Question.
Yes.
What do you mean by the risk of thermalization?
The what?
Risk of thermalization.
The width of...
The next page. You said the rate of heating is supposed to be much smaller than the rate of thermalization.
Oh, the rate of heating.
What do you mean by the rate of thermalization?
The rate of thermalization is kind of how long it takes for a system to reach local equilibrium with itself.
Does it depend on the driving?
So in the limit that we're going to be studying, no. Generically, of course, when you're driving it, you're modifying a system a bit and you could affect its rate. To zero order, for what I'm going to be talking about in this talk, it's independent of the drive. It's a property of the static Hamiltonian.
So the first line here really means the rate of heating due to driving is much smaller
yes.
than the rate of thermalization due to the static part.
Yes, you can kind of interpret that to zero order, yeah. The rate of thermalization, you know, kind of depends on certain classical quantities like, you know, heat conductivity, etc., you know. Yes.
But generically, the heating on the left-hand side is part of the thermalization.
Well, okay, so right now, I guess I'm using heating right now specifically to mean anything that changes the energy. So the static part of the Hamiltonian won't change its energy. Is the drive that will change its energy. So I've kind of made a dichotomy of to separate the drive part, which is responsible for the heating, as well as to the static part, which I'm claiming is responsible for the thermalization, although that's not kind of a rigorous statement.
So if your static system is integrable?
If your static system is integrable, then it won't thermalize, or you're gonna require the drive to perturb it enough so that it becomes no longer integrable. But then you run into cases where you have a really long thermalization time. Okay, thank you for these questions. And so for us to study this flow cape pre-thermalization physics, what we really want is one, once again, the drive frequency to be much larger than the single body energy. So in terms of the variables we hear, we want omega to be much larger than J. Where J is the kind of coefficients in front of the static Hamiltonian. At the same time, we also want the many body bandwidth to be much larger than drive frequency. And the reason is that if your drive frequency is larger than the many body bandwidth, then there's no target state to kind of transition into, right? It's like if you take like a qubit at say, you know, one megahertz and you drive it at like terahertz, nothing will happen because there's no state it can transition to. It's the same idea. And so we all have to have a sufficiently large system size, which is what controls the many-body bandwidth, compared to the system compared to the drive frequency. And if you combine these together, you find out that well, you need a two orders of limit, separations of scales. I mean, you need the system size to be much larger than omega over J, which is much larger than one, in order to kind of achieve this flow cape pre-thermalization physics. And one of the things is that. Questions that I want to address is how do we study these questions theoretically? Because you run into problems, because of both of these, you run into problems where L becomes much larger than most standard methods can numerically handle. And so a little bit of, you know, philosophy with that, what we want to do, of course, is we want to simulate a quantum system, say in this case, the cat, inside a classical computer. Which is what we have, in order to get kind of a bunch of, you know, quantities. And the standard law is that this typically requires an exponential amount of resources to study any quantum dynamical systems because of, you know, the complexity of the wave function. And so what I have here is a kind of a schematic map of the numerical methods that we have in one dimension to study dynamical systems. The two axes is kind of system size and time. So I'll talk a little bit about these kind of various techniques and the regime they're applicable at. And there's this giant big question mark right here, which is the regime that we really want to study, which I'll talk about in a bit. So this talk is somewhat split into two parts. One of the questions that we raise and that we're going to answer is what happens when you kind of combine all these various aspects of physics, which is flow case physics, thermalization, and hydrodynamics. What happens if you combine them, and what's emergent, what comes out? And another very related question in order to actually attack this is that how do we study this system? What numerical technique we're going to use? And what I'm actually going to do for the rest of this talk is I'm going to talk slightly briefly about this, talking about the numerical technique, a little bit about what we do. And then I'll talk about the results of studying the systems and what we can get out of it. Okay? All right, so that was kind of the introduction. All right, so in terms of the numerical technique, the problem that once again we want is that we want some initial wave function. We're given some Hamiltonian. In this case, I'm using a static Hamiltonian as an example, but this is applicable for a time-dependent one, and you just want to evolve in time. And one of the techniques is basically construct a unitary and apply it to your state. The reason why this is so difficult is that any quantum state requires an exponential large number in order to kind of capture exactly. And so that limits the system size that you can go into in these type brute force algorithms. And this is kind of what's represented here in the exact representation. The exact representations has a hard cutoff in system size, typically on all of 20-ish, because that's when a typical computer runs out of memory. And because it's exponentially hard in system size L, you can get, you know, a computer that's twice as good, and you'll get like system size one more. And so that's the limitation on that. Now, over the past decade or so, there's been a new technique called matrix product states, which is a class of tensor networks, where you represent the states kind of as not exactly, but using an ansatz. And there's a control parameter called a bond dimension, which is kind of tells you how much memory you need in order to capture the state. And in some cases, it turns out you don't need a very large bond dimension, which is why it's successful in some cases. The bond dimension in the matrix product state language is related to the entanglement entropy in that it bands the amount of entanglement entropy you allow between the different parts of your subsystem. So, so for example, if I were to start from a state with like a product state that has no entanglement entropy, and I were just to evolve in time, the entanglement entropy generically grows with time. And most generically for a thermalized or delocalized state, there's some linear growth of entanglement entropy, S. And we're not going to analyze the localized case here. But because the bond dimension typically scales exponentially with the entanglement entropy, what it means is that you need exponential amount of resources as a function of time in order to use these matrix products techniques. And so that is the basic idea about these matrix product states are capable of capturing arbitrary system sizes, but there's kind of a hard cutoff in time instead of in system size for which they can go on to. So that leaves open the question of what can you do in this region where you're kind of at the intermediate to long time scales, but you want to study large system sizes. And to this end, I'm going to motivate an idea based on the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. And it comes back to thermalization. And one of the questions, what does it mean for a system to be thermalized? Well, the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis says that basically eigenstates, or in general, any kind of generic state at a particular energy, is indistinguishable from each other locally. Even though, of course, different eigenstates have to be orthogonal, locally you can't tell them apart. Specifically, if you take any local observable of an eigenstate, the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis says that it looks the same as if you were to take a mixed state, a Gibbs ensemble, or an average, and just measure the same local quantity. And what this tells you is that even though a wave function, highly excited wave function carries lots of actual quantum information, locally you can really only extract a small subset of it. Most of that information in some sense is very difficult to recover and information that you don't really care about. And so that's kind of the first motivation. And what it basically means is that in a thermalized system, all these large unbounded entanglement entropy or volume law entanglement, in some sense, can just be replaced by thermal entropy because there's no local way to tell them apart. And this is what the basic idea behind using a new numerical technique. So we call this new numerical technique density matrix truncation, DMT for short. And the basic idea is that it's really hard to capture a quantum state once again, exactly, because of the growth of entanglement over time. But most of that growth of entanglement is in informations which are in long-range entanglement, which are really not something that you can observe easily, and we can get the same physics out by replacing them with thermal fluctuations. And in such, instead of representing these states as pure wave functions, and they're pure because we're doing like unitary time dynamics, we're gonna represent these states as density matrices, where we're gonna try to match local observables, but we don't care about global properties. So psi is kind of like a target state that we want out of some time dynamics. And what we want is, of course, we want local observables to, you know, give you the correct thing. But what we don't care about is we don't care that globally what we have is the same. And as it turns out, there is a tensor network, a matrix product operator representation for thermalized states that we can take advantage of. And so that's the basis idea behind DMT. This is kind of like a summary of the method DMT. And so this DMT is what we're going to use to study this region right here. Now, I purposely didn't tell you any detail about this numerical technique. And that's actually in the paper there. That's actually been published. I didn't write that in. But the basic idea is that we have this numerical technique that basically formalizes the system. All right, so here's the Floquet Hamiltonian again. It's the same Hamiltonian, now with parameters. So the static Hamiltonian is the first three terms. It involves a nearest neighbor Z coupling, XX coupling, and also X coupling. And the reason why we have these three terms is that these three guarantees is not integrable. Any two of those three terms is integrable, which means it doesn't thermalize. And the last term is the drive. And we're gonna do some block drive. It doesn't actually matter what the drive is. It's the lowest frequency of the drive that matters, so. So this is what we're gonna study, and I'm just gonna present the results. So this is one of the results of the time simulation. And there's actually a lot of stuff here, so I need to explain that. All right, so what I'm plotting here is I'm plotting the expectation value, ignore the inset. I'm plotting the expectation value of some operator as a function of time on a log plot, or semi-log plot. And this is just some quantity that's that we just choose because it's convenient to measure. And what you see is that it's separate into various time regions. So the different colors corresponds to different frequency drives. So we keep the same static Hamiltonian, but we do the drive at different frequencies. And these omegas are in units of J. So there's the early time part, for which basically you get a lot of transient dynamics because this is a quantum quench. And then you kind of see a smooth a flattening, at, especially at the largest frequency, omega equals to 10. You see a flattening, and then it slowly approaches zero, which corresponds to the infinite temperature. So what we claim is that this is the pre-thermalization plateau. This is where it has achieved kind of local equilibrium, local thermalization, and this corresponds to some temperature, and it's slowly heating up to infinite temperature. So at infinite temperature, this expectation value goes to zero.
Sorry, what's your initial state look like?
The initial state is some product state. It's just like some arrangement of up and down spins.
Okay.
All right, so we also do a few things here. So this actual data is actually done for only a length 20 chain. So it's actually not a very long chain. But we actually do it for two techniques. We do it for the DMT, which I just introduced. And we do it for kind of a much more traditional Krylov technique that's been well established. And one of the reasons we do that is for benchmarking purposes. So the dotted lines is the technique that's basically exact. But because of that, we can only do small system sizes. The continuous lines are for DMT. And for the most part, they match very well. They match quite well for early times. They match quite well for late times. There's some deviations here. In fact, you can see a dot line follows one set of curves and the solid line follows another set, which I'll talk about a bit later. So there is a deviation between DMT and a kind of a much closer to exact method Krylov. But for the most part, most of the physics I'm going to talk about is identical. And this is one benchmark to kind of, you know, to get you to believe this technique really does work. All right, so physics-wise, there are two main time scales, and one of them is already indicated by the dashed line here. The first time scale is what we call is a cumbersome notation, tau d effective. It's a time scale to reach the pre-thermalization plateau, and it's usually on the order of inverse j. It's the time scale so that locally it reaches a thermal equilibrium. The second time scale, which we call tau star, is the time scale it kind of heats up due to the flow k drive. And keep in mind that because omega is large, that time scales we can tune to be much larger. And so if you look at data, the dashed line right here corresponds to roughly the first time scale, which is the time scale reaches pre-thermalized plateau. And you can see that, and I'll explain what these three plots are, but for all three plots, the data looks basically flat right after that. And then tau star is basically dependent on frequency, how long it takes to reach the infinite temperature. So in each of these plots, you can tell that there's different behaviors with different frequencies, which means there's a different tau star for every frequency. But they should all expect to have the same tau d effective.
How much does tau d effective depend on the initial state?
It depends quite strongly on the initial state because it is a characterized how long it takes to thermalize locally. So it does. But I mean, it was not going to depend drastically, like maybe a factor of two or three based on initial states, generically. But it is sensitive to that. All right, so one of the three plots. All right, so the top plot, the middle plot you've seen already. Previously, the top plot is the energy density as a function of time. And the bottom plot is the entanglement entropy of the first free qubit as a function of time of the chain. And for all these, what you basically see is that there's some wiggles in the beginning, with the exception of this, which I'll talk about in a second. There's some wiggles in the beginning. It seems to flatten out for a bit. And then based on what the frequency of the drive is, it approaches this infinite temperature value. So you can clearly see these timescales on all these plots. The reason why you don't get the wiggles in this plot is because this is basically the expectation value of H static. At early times, the drive basically does nothing because the drive is exponentially, the effect is exponentially small. So which means at early times, it's basically a static drive. And so the expectation value of exactly that is constant, which is why you don't see any wiggles. See, it just basically tells you that at early times, you get no heating because this is all a log plot. So this tells you various things, and there's various things to pick out. Once again, emphasize that these data are taken with we do both Krylov and DMT, and once again, you can see that they basically match, except for kind of these intermediate times, which is good. And so this is just explaining with what the energy means. When we say the energy, we just meant the expectation value to, this is a different notation for the H static, which is constant in the beginning because the heating rate is so slow. One of the other things that we also want to look at, because we mentioned that we want to study hydrodynamics, and hydrodynamics, the easiest way to get out of it is inhomogeneous stuff. And so what we want to do now is we want to do an inhomogeneous drive. So previously you've been doing kind of a homogeneous drive just to see the physics of thermalization. Now we want to see some hydrodynamics. And the basic thing we do is that we just take the drive and we only drive half the system. We do some step function drive where we only drive the right half of the system and not the left half. The static Hamiltonian is on the entire system. And when we do this, what we see is these are snapshots at different time for a fixed frequency. So this is the earliest time, and this is the later time. And you can, this is increasing in energy, so it's heating up. Now I'm driving the right half and not the left half, so you expect the right half to have a higher temperature than the left half, and indeed it does. And over time, now moreover, we're driving with a step function, but the energy profile isn't a step function, it's a curve. And what that reflects is that energy is leaking from one side to the other side. And the fact that curves are going up is also telling you that the left side is heating up. It's heating up, it's lagging behind the right half. And it's easy to explain why, because the right half is directly being driven by the flow cage, and it's heating directly from that, but the left half is getting heat through diffusion. So what we're seeing here is both diffusion, which is hydrodynamics, and basically this flow cage heating from these snapshots and these inhomogeneous profile. And in fact, we can actually do measurements. So what actually is shown here is that the colors is actually the data. The dashed line turns out to be a fit. From the fit, we can do a number of things. We can extract the time scale for heating. We can extract diffusion coefficients, etc. So an example is that we could try extract the time scale for heating, which is basically from one shot to the next shot, what percentage of the energy is gained. And we see that as a function of frequency, this time scale, T star, is linear. Sorry, not linear, exponential, because it's a log plot. So we do confirm that omega, that the heating rate is exponential in the drive frequency. Moreover, what we can do see is that the half drive, which are these lines, compared to the global drive where we drive everything, is half as much. The heating rate is half as much, which kind of makes sense because when you drive half the system, you heat up half as much. This is just a fancy way of showing the ratio is very close to 2. And so here you can see emergent hydrodynamics in this flow cage system. I should emphasize this simulation is done for a chain of length 100. And we had to do this large because if you're going to drive half the system and look at the profile, you need to make sure that your system size is sufficiently large compared to, you know, the other the diffusion time scales. And this is one reason why we needed a numerical technique to study this. This isn't something that you can ever do with one of the existing techniques. So what we have kind of done is that we've demonstrated that DMT seems to do pretty well and gives you a lot of things, and we can extract a number of observable quantities. And it's what we want to do is we want to step back and ask a little bit, like, why does it actually work so well? Because it's clearly an approximation, and where it fails. So I didn't really tell you what the algorithm was, but the basic idea is that this is similar to TBD, where you do a time evolution step, you truncate to reduce the bond dimension, and then you just kind of repeat time evolution, truncate. It's the same idea, except you do it on the density matrix. And it turns out the way you do it is a bit non-trivial, and I did not give you any of the technical details of that. But one of the things the DMT is designed to do is to conserve all the local variables, observables, I meant, during a truncation step, which is to say that before the truncation, after truncation, all the local observables are the same. And it turns out standard truncation procedures say that you do for matrix product states do not actually have this property. Which means that if you were to run time evolution for just, you know, typical matrix product state, besides one of the problems where you run into a volume law entanglement, the other problem is that your energy is actually not conserved, the errors accumulate. Whereas DMT, we kind of design algorithms so those errors do not accumulate, or at least they're only like numerical errors. And then what does it guarantee?
Local observables that are not changed.
during truncation steps. I mean, they obviously change during time evolution.
What kind of guarantee, like the infinite number of local observables?
Well, when we say local observable, okay, for finite system size, there's a finite number of them.
But there are still many, right?
There are many, right. It turns out to guarantee, because we're working with density matrices, to guarantee that local observables don't change, local observables are linear functions of density matrices. So to guarantee they don't change, we just write down all the local observables and turn it into a linear constraint equation. So that in terms of the density matrix, there's like a number of linear constraint equations that we have to satisfy. And so it turns out linear constraints are pretty easy to implement in any, because at the end of the day, it's all linear algebra. And so when we trunk it, we just enforce that we only search within that linear space. That's basically how we do it. It's much harder to do it in the standard matrix product state language because that would be a quadratic constraint to conserve local observables. So that's actually one advantage of working with density matrices, that linear constraints are easy to implement. If you want, I have details on more slides. It guarantees local energy conservation. So for example, what it does, it guarantees that the total energy of the system is going to remain unchanged. What it doesn't guarantee, of course, is that the distribution of the energy is true. And one of the reasons is, of course, this is still an approximation. While local observables are preserved, long-range observables aren't preserved, and those still have an effect on the time evolution on local observables. They could change the distribution. They just won't change the total energy. So you still get conservation of charge and energy, but it's just that you get a slightly different diffusion constant than the true one. And so that's one control parameter you have to take into account.
Where do you put the boundary between local observables and non-local observables?
It's an arbitrary parameter, which is called L. Let me see if I have any plot. I'll plot later. Right now I'm picking free. So we keep all the free site local observables, which is bigger than the size of each term in the Hamiltonian. It's the parameter in the algorithm that you just, it's one of those numbers we also play around with to see what's optimal, but it's just a parameter you play with. What we call local and what we call long range. Thank you. And the basic idea is that DMT captures the short range quantum correlations because it keeps all the local observables, but it throws away the long distance correlations and replaces them with thermal, kind of thermal entropy in some sense. And with that, it's useful to kind of examine the various errors that you can get in DMT. So what we have here is we're looking at basically the same data as we looked at before, where we compared the Krylov to the DMT for small system sizes. And here now we're going to focus on the deviations. In particular, there's deviations here at intermediate time. So it's very short time right here. They all seem to basically match. Well, kind of here. And this is true for all tensor network technique because until you saturate your bond dimension, your representation is exact. So we have this region where certain features which comes from, you know, so these two pieces, we can actually know where it comes from. It comes from actually energy, comes from the system size over the velocity, the leap Robinson velocity. So these are kind of reentrant like features of, you know, things going back and forth, and DMT just throws them away, where like if you kept them exactly, you can see these like oscillation that depends on system sizes. And so it clearly throws these away because these are inherently long distance correlations. And that's why it fails to get these features correctly. And what we have here is the error between the Krylov, which we take as exact, and the DMT at various bond dimension. And we can see that the larger the bond dimension, the smaller the error. So these are all controllable errors, but they are the errors. What we also then look at is the long time. And right now in this plot, it's not very clear how what deviations are. So what we did was we actually plot it back on a linear scale. And we look at the long time dynamics and how the Krylov, which is the solid line, differs from the various DMT at different bond dimensions. So the blue set is one frequency, 9. The red set is frequency 10. And up is increasing in bond dimension. And the solid one is the exact one. So what it means is increasing bond dimension also makes it more accurate. What you What I want to point out is that the larger the bond dimension, the heating rate, actually, let me back up. There's actually something that I forgot to say. So in the intermediate time scales, when we compare the Krylov to the DMT, it's missing these things. And one of the reasons it's missing these things, as I mentioned, is because it's throwing away long-range correlations. And one way you can understand that is what it does is over-thermalizes the system. Because earlier, I mentioned how it replaces long-range entanglement entropy with like thermal entropy. Well, in some sense, it thermalizes the system quicker than it would normally by itself. And so you typically expect it to kind of reach this pre-thermal plateau slightly earlier than what the Krylov would suggest. So the early time it over-thermalizes. Now what this is long time. This is when it's leaving the pre-thermalized plateau, so the time scale is now on the order of 1,000 into the infinite temperature. And what we see is that it under-thermalizes. In that the larger the bond dimension, the higher the thermalization rate is. And we can quantify that. In the inset is the difference between the DMT once again versus the Krylov. As a function of bond dimension, and we see, of course, the error rates go down as a function of bond dimension. But we see that the error is larger for larger omega. And I only have two sets of data here, but small omega is better and large omega is worse. And what it means is that larger drive frequency that gives you a slower heating rate in DMT compared to Krylov. The heating rate is already exponentially slower, but DMT makes even slower than that as a result of finite bond dimension. So once again, to summarize, at small intermediate times, the algorithm DMT over-thermalizes it. It reaches the pre-thermal plateau a bit quicker than it should. And as a result, it misses certain dynamical features. On the other hand, at late times, it under-thermalizes, which means it reaches infinite temperature much slower than the flow cake heating. And this difference actually reveals a lot about the physics of how these two mechanisms happen. It tells you that they're actually driven by two different mechanisms. And in particular, how thermalization typically happens at short times is that you have a chain that's kind of inhomogeneous. And then over time, the short distance is thermalized. And what it means is that the local, say, one site density matrix resembles that of the Gibbs ensemble. And then later, the two site density matrix looks like that of the Gibbs ensemble and the free site, et cetera. Right? So you can imagine it's becoming locally, it's looking like the Gibbs ensemble at a slight bigger and bigger distance over time until it reaches kind of like what the DMT kind of length scale is, in which case then the whole thing, according to DMT, is thermalized, even though realistically it's still increasing in its kind of thermalization length. So in other words, DMT accelerates this process. It just makes the local thermalization process a bit quicker, which is why it over-thermalizes it. On the other hand, at late times, the system's already locally thermal. Right, because it locally looks thermal, it's in the pre-thermal plateau. The heating mechanism isn't induced by changing what happens locally, but it's induced by absorbing a frequency omega change, which is a many-body process in some sense. It involves a non-local rearrangement, because local rearrangement is only on order J. So what it means is that this thermalization actually doesn't happen at the short length scale, but it happens on a length scale on the order omega over J at a long time. It's why it's exponentially suppressed, but this thermalization has to do with some quantum rearrangement of the system, and which eventually trickles down to the short distance scales and heats up the system. And it's because this is nucleated from a long distance physics, it's why DMT actually slows this process down. Because DMT captures short distance quantum mechanics well, but the long distance it does it only approximately. And so the fact that these two processes are different is reflected in the way the algorithm behaves as you increase bond dimension. And this is something we find very remarkable, that this method also tells differentiates between different mechanisms. All right, so I'm going to summarize. We study basically, you know, a certain quantum dynamical problem. We study a particular problem that involves both flow K physics, thermalization, and exhibit hydrodynamical behavior. I've talked briefly about the center around this as a new numerical technique to study this. I've kind of told you, you know, like did some benchmark, and I also kind of told you what it's good at and like how to interpret the result. And importantly, we find out that the heating mechanism between different times is different. So anyway, thank you very much for your time.
You said, I think at some point, you might have some figure showing the effect of increasing the range that you consider for that you keep exactly.
Yeah. This is not the plot. This is not the plot. Okay, hold on. Hold on, it's in the paper. Hold on, now I need to find the paper. Okay. All right, so in the paper, which is on archive. Oh, actually, okay, yeah, this one. Okay, the right one, which is the one I didn't show, I showed the left one. What we did was instead of varying the bond dimension, we fixed the bond dimension, and we vary what we call L, which is the number of sites of operators that we keep exactly. So three is the minimum, but we can keep five sites, which means that at the truncation, we guarantee all five sites observables, and they are like 4 to the 5 of them are all kept exactly. And basically, this is an error. Eta is an error. And we find out, for example, based on what the bond dimension is, like 256, it turns out that keeping five sites is better than keeping three sites, but keeping seven sites isn't better than keeping five sites. So there's like a tuning parameter where based on how many sites you keep, you get better or worse errors.
So is the 7 worse because you would need a larger bond dimension?
Yeah, we think so. Yeah, we think so. We think, yeah, so we suspect a larger bond dimension 7 will become optimal, and then it wasn't exactly tested, but that's what we think.
So I guess the point of looking at a pre-thermal regime was to have like a large regime where you can compare these two methods, or?
Well, that's definitely one motivation, is that we can compare these methods by having a pre-thermal regime. But it also allows us to like extract certain, like it allows us to test the long time behavior of DMT, or in general, just explore long time dynamics of systems. Generic systems without pre-thermal plateau is just infinite temperature. So long time dynamics is kind of boring. So pre-thermalization is an example, and time crystal also another example where the long time dynamics is interesting to study, and that's something that why we're interested in the problem.
But have you also tested DMT on like an ordinary thermalizing system?
Yeah, it just reaches infinite temperature at some speed. It actually reaches it faster than it should because it over-thermalizes and it just stays at infinite temperature. So then you can get certain equilibrium properties. I should say for flow K systems, it reaches infinite temperature. For static system, we tested it. It reaches whatever temperature it should, and it just gets there faster than it should. So it'll tell you what kind of the final state is, but the way it gets there is a bit quicker than it should. You can still get useful information out, like diffusion constant and stuff like that. And that's something that we actually did do somewhere here, is that if you turn off the flow K thing, we could measure the diffusion constant. It's just more interesting when you drive it.
Any other questions?
So does it apply to the infinite system?
I don't see a reason why we can't apply to an infinite system, at least a translational system. The algorithm right now only works for finite system. In theory, it should work for infinite, but we've never thought carefully about how the algorithm works. What we're actually thinking about next is long-range interacting systems. That's kind of a, yes.
Yeah, so actually, it seems like the time region that you're looking at this, the system already knows about it's in some finite system size.
So in a sense that you're actually taking the long time limit first before you're taking the larger system size, right? But is a hydrodynamical regime conventionally more talking about you have to have a large enough system first and then you take a long, you look at the...
Well, we definitely need large system for hydrodynamics. The hydrodynamics regime basically shows up whenever locally, it kind of just looks thermal. So I don't believe those two limits necessarily has to do with each other. You definitely want both to be in the hydrodynamics regime. Our method just makes one go faster than the other one. I don't know if that answers your question, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just curious, like, because usually if you want something representative of thermodynamic limit in time, then you actually want to take L goes to infinite first before you take L T.
That is true, but it turns out when you're working at a finite temperature, there's kind of like a space length scale beyond which you don't really get interesting physics, so it turns out you don't really have to send that to infinity.
How does numerical error scale
with the
exponentially or
exponentially? Oh, no idea. Besides Dan, I mean, sometimes it scales, this will be a log scaling, I guess. What is it? Yeah, kind of. Which is kind of poor. Sometimes it's this is a algebraic scaling. Yeah. I mean, it would be nice if it was algebraic, but we never tested it.
Okay, well, thanks, Roger.
Thank you.